Memory Static is a listener-supported podcast. Your contributions really make a difference in helping us keep the show going. So please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/memorystatic. Enjoy the show.
Hey, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Whoa. Oh, what happened to your leg?
I'm sorry.
I know it's kind of impolite to ask, but I'm a little worried.
No, that's okay. It's a pretty obvious limp. And I guess better to get this out of the way. But I was attacked by some greasers.
No way.
Yeah. Last night, I went to a 50s-themed party as a housewarming party. But so you know how when you have those parties, you like have the time machine switch? Somebody spilled some beer on it, so we got stuck in the past for a while.
I know how that goes.
Yeah.
Don't we, Eric?
Yeah, it was terribly unfortunate. So I had to spend the night in the 50s. I had to figure out a different themed party to go to so I could use their time machine to get back over here. And yeah, it was just quite an ordeal.
Man, I need to go to more of these themed parties. I need to check out their time machines.
Yeah, there's quite an array out there. I feel like different people have different models. The 50s one that we had was pretty cool. It was like, it looked like a TV, but the TV screen was only like 6 inches wide, but the whole thing was like 3 feet wide. It was pretty great.
Wow. And so actual greasers attacked you and hurt your leg?
Yeah. Walking down the street, So 50s attire is really weird. Whenever you wear makeup, it has to match your shoes, it has to match your purse, it has to match your washing machine. And I just like don't have that many accessories in my closet. And so they're actually representatives of the fashion police. And so they were mad at my faux pas.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad that I'm not back at the 50s.
Yeah.
It's so much worse than I imagined.
Yeah.
And it was already pretty bad.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
That's quite a story. With that, welcome back to Memory Static,
the podcast
that digs up the movies you loved when you were little, talks about them, and throws a party to watch them. And there's a new original song at the end of every episode written by me and my brother, Cullen Moore. I'm Bailey Moore. And our guest tonight is Haley Clement. I forgot to ask you how to pronounce your last name.
Oh, yeah. Haley Clement.
Okay, great. And we know how you got here, which is a wild story.
Yeah, I'm all scuffed up a little bit. I've got some comb sticking out of me.
Comb? Greaser comb. Oh, my gosh. The flip combs.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I sat on one a minute ago.
Do you need a Band-Aid?
I will. I don't want to bleed all over your couch.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Well, so tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're working on right now.
Like what I'm working on, like the things that I like to do?
Well, yeah, like the thing, like you talked about your podcast and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I do a couple different things. I really like the way things sound. And so I've been kind of exploring that with my Instagram. That's very cool, called Eat Every Sound. And it's like food noises, like, ripping apart grapefruit skins or, pouring sugar on a glass surface.
That is so awesome.
Yeah. I really like that.
You must use really, really good microphones for that.
Yeah. I have some friends who help out who have really good microphones. It's cool. 'Cause a lot of people, who are into this are also like other sound nerds. And so then there's a lot of knowledgeable people I can ask.
What's one of your favorite sounds?
Slicing celery.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
You know what? One sound that I've always really loved is river rocks,
mm-hmm.
picking them up and dropping them on one another.
Yeah.
They make this noise that really tastes very good in my mouth. I don't. I guess it's a little synesthesia, but I've always really loved that sound.
Yeah, that sounds nice. I feel like it would smell good too. Like it almost seems like it would be, like despite being river rocks, it almost sounds like it would be kind of dry sound, like a really nice solid clink.
Yes. Oh, it's so good. anyway, let's get to what we're... Oh, is there anything else you wanted to plug before we move on?
Yeah, if that's okay.
Oh yeah, yeah, of course.
I also work on a video game podcast. I do the sound for that. So I like make the sound effects and I like do the engineering, and that's called Game Boys Pod. I'm working on another podcast, or this one I'm researching for, and I really like it. And right now the working title is Gastroanthropology because it's about food history.
I love that. Is it like getting into like cuisine or like individual foods and our history with them, like mushrooms or something like
that? Yeah, kind of more ingredient focused.
Okay.
But like in the original gambit was looking at foods that either came to America and became institutionalized American things, or foods that left America and became more known other places.
Okay.
Like Thai chili peppers, they came from the US, or not the United States, they came from the Americas.
Or like potatoes came from South America.
Potatoes and tomatoes and... Like, so looking at things that maybe came from here, but got their true identity like elsewhere.
I love that. That is so fascinating.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear it.
Oh, thank you. It's a lot of fun to work on.
Yeah, I bet. I bet the research is really fun.
Yeah, I love it. I love reading like really, really old cookbooks because they have titles that are like 100 words long. Like I have one on my phone.
Oh, yes. Please tell.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. This might take a quick second, but I know exactly where it is. Okay. So I need to take a deep breath before I even say this one because it's so long. How to Mix Drinks, or The Bon Vivant's Companion, containing clear and reliable directions for mixing all the beverages used in the United States, together with the most popular British, French, German, Italian, Russian, and Spanish recipes, embracing punches, juleps, cobblers, etc., etc., in endless variety. To which is appended a manual for the manufacture of cordials, liquors, fancy syrups, etc., etc., after the most approved methods now used in the distillation of liquors and beverages, designed for the special use of manufacturers and dealers in wines and spirits, grocers, tavern keepers, and private families, the same being adapted to the trade of the United States and Canada.
Oh my gosh, I think I just died of thirst.
Yeah. And... I love this one. This
it's
one's
so
fun.
Good.
Yeah. The whole thing is really funny. It's by Jerry Thomas, who's actually he's the father of cocktails. Like he's the reason why cocktails exist. They're an American thing, apparently. And this book also contains the very first written recipe of Jell-O shots.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how old is it?
This is from 1862.
Wow. Jell-O shots are that old.
Yeah. There's evidence that it might be older. There's a French cookbook that you could argue might have been Jell-O shots, but it almost seems a bit saucier and it's more savory. This one's definitely sweet and closer to the Jell-O shots we know.
I wonder what the flavor was, like the common flavor of Jell-O at the time.
They would
Maybe
do
cherry.
They would use like citrus. Surprisingly, because citrus interacts funny with gelatin and like is actually kind of hard to make it, but if you use like the peel oils more than the juice, then that can work out pretty well.
That is so interesting. I cannot wait for your podcast.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, we should talk about the movie.
Yeah. It deserves a lot of talk.
What movie are we watching tonight?
Tonight, we're going to watch The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Yes. I'm so excited.
Me too.
And I think a lot of the people that are coming tonight have never seen it, so I'm really excited for them to see it for the first time. for anybody watching at home, probably the easiest way to watch The Adventures of Baron Munchausen is by renting it on Amazon Prime. Here in Austin, we are fortunate enough to have not one, but two video rental stores. And I was able to rent the DVD from I Love Video, which is the closest one to where I live. So support your local video stores if you've got them, because you have a lot more variety than what the streaming services are limited to.
Yeah, they're a true treasure trove.
Yes. And the experience is great. Just browsing and picking something out. It's just something you don't get to do anymore. So how old were you when you first watched this?
I think I was around 6 years old the first time I watched it. It was something that we actually watched a lot in our childhood. Like, I don't know if you did this, but we used to always like watch the same movies over and over again.
Of course.
Yeah. So me and my sister would rent this one quite often.
Yeah. So you rented it.
Yeah. With my dad, we had this kind of like weekly practice of going to Blockbuster, and then like each of us would get a movie, and so he'd generally get like a new one because he wasn't a child,
and then want to watch the same thing over and over.
Yeah, and me and my sister had like about a dozen that we would rotate through, but this one I liked the most. I would actually switch between this one and Time Bandits a lot. I didn't know they were related.
That's cool.
Yeah.
When was the last time you watched this? Was it recently?
It's actually been a while. I think I watched it last in 2011, like mm-hmm. around when I graduated college.
Okay, so it's been a little while.
Yeah.
Why did you choose this movie?
This one, so it holds kind of a magical place in my mind. I watched it a bunch as a kid, and then after about 10 or so, I kind of forgot about it. I didn't remember that it existed, and it like disappeared out of my mind.
It's kind of dreamlike.
Yeah, super duper. And then when I tried searching for it, I couldn't find it. Like, I just couldn't think of the right search term. So then that made it seem even more like unreal and dreamlike. And especially since like even the stuff that I remembered about the plot, like some of it I made up. Some of it was actually happened. Some of it was in like the wrong order. Because one of the things that I remember most about this movie as a kid is it felt like every time I watched it was different. Because sometimes I would remember something and then it wouldn't happen the way I remembered, or sometimes something totally new would happen, or like sometimes it seems like things happened in different order. Mm-hmm. So the whole movie just like didn't feel like it really existed.
Because it was always different.
Yeah.
Yeah. It had so many different moving parts that it was just like it morphed.
Yeah. Yeah. And like a lot of the movie kind of plays with like chronology and like linear time. Mm-hmm. So like it makes sense now, but for a long time it just sort of felt magical. And it was a big part of my childhood because I watched it all the time.
I would think like watching it as a 6-year-old, this would be a difficult movie to really process, but there's so much visual stuff going on that it would be enthralling.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I had a very mixed understanding of like cause and effect in the movie. And so I would like understand one scene as it was happening, but it like grasping the whole took a long time. And I remember kind of like feeling more as I would watch it eventually, like things would click and make sense. And so it made the movie feel really rich mm-hmm. because I kept being able to get more and more out of it.
So the movie is about someone that tells tall tales. And in this case, like Baron Munchausen actually does live through those things. We journey with him.
Yeah.
But did you or any friends love to tell tall tales?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Growing up, I grew up with a sister, and we had a cousin who was like a year, like me and my sister are 2 years apart, and Jacqueline was in the middle. And so we were always playing together a lot. And a lot of our stories were, or a lot of our games were kind of story-based or imagination-based. Like a lot of times we would actually have games that were most about, do we need to hold for planes? No. Oh, okay, cool. A lot of times we would have games that were most about sort of eliciting an emotional reaction, like if we could make each other laugh. Like there was one where, I don't think I've told you about this before, but I like it a lot, where two of us would pretend to be ghosts and then one person was alive, and if they could make the ghost laugh, then the ghost would come back to life.
That's such a great game. Love that. So how would what would be the approach to bring the ghost back to life?
So that like you'd have to make them laugh, and then once they laughed, then you had to go do like the ritualistic dance around the graveyard
to make them rise from the dead.
Yeah, and we had like chairs that we would play it behind, so that way like the different chairs would be the tombstones.
Oh my gosh, it's so, there's so much detail in this game. It's great.
Yeah, we always played it in the same spot at my grandma's house. Like, and so if we were at somebody else's house, like we would play different games. Like there was one at my aunt's house, we would always play the opera singer game because she had a fireplace that was like a stage. Mm-hmm. And so like somebody would be the opera singer, and then somebody in the audience would fall madly in love and then try to kidnap them. And then the other person would have to rescue them. And we would do like, I mentioned this one earlier, we would make map making games. So we would make a big map of wherever we were, like whether it was my grandma's house or my aunt's house. And then we would like leave X's and marks and clues and things like that. And then we would actually write up clues, like about a dozen of them. And so like each clue would have like a riddle or a rhyme, and it would, you would like go get it, and then you would like go to the next one and then go to the next one. And the map would give you clues about the world that the, like the map would kind of tell you what the clues were referring to. So if the map, there was like a mountain range, and then one of the poems was about a mountain range, then you know like, oh, the mountain range is actually like the couch this time.
I love how many different avenues of creativity are in that one game.
Yeah.
Like art, literary stuff,
yeah,
and adventure, play acting.
Yeah.
It's great.
There's a lot of like fighting monkey pirates and stuff like that.
You reminded me, because you did share that story with me before. It reminded me of something that my sister and I did when we were little.
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't that involved, but... both of us were born in New Orleans.
Oh.
And my parents lived there a couple years before we were born. So when we moved to Houston, we came with a giant treasure trove of Mardi Gras beads.
Yeah.
And so much so that when I was 4 years old, either it was either my birthday or my sister's birthday, my mom made all of us, all of the party guests, sit cross-legged in a circle when she dumped a whole bunch of Mardi Gras beads in the middle and said, okay, grab as many as you can and then you get to take them home. And that was the game.
Yeah.
And but that didn't get rid of all of them. So when we moved into the house that that Chaney and I grew up in, we still had a lot of Mardi Gras beads. And so when my parents would go on a date or they had something to do, we'd have a babysitter come over, and yeah, my sister and I would string all of these Mardi Gras beads together end on end and make a path that went all the way through the house and into different rooms and up the stairs and then back down the stairs. And we made our babysitter follow the trail. And maybe we hid at the end of it, or we had some kind of treasure at the end of it. I can't really remember what it was, but that's what I remember doing, just the setup,
yeah,
of this treasure hunt following the Mardi Gras jewelry.
Yeah. That's cool. I'm from Louisiana too. So we had the similar thing where we just had like a million beads all the time, because like kids want to hold on to stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great thing to have when you're a kid.
Like, yeah.
Put like, I don't know, 100 different strings of beads around your neck. You're like, I'm filthy rich. Yeah. Look at all my shiny plastic.
Absolutely.
Well, I think the party guests are starting to arrive, so I can hear the time machine starting to warm up, kind of beckoning.
Yeah, I thought I heard some clanking.
Yeah, that's it.
All right.
We did improve it, but it's still making lots of noise.
Nice.
So are you ready?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so watch your step.
Okay.
All time machine systems online. Systems, go.
Oh, I like the lighting that you have in here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. We've been messing with dimmers lately.
Oh.
You know, like, you know, creating the mood. Like, what is the correct mood for a time machine?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We're experimenting.
Yeah, you gotta play with it.
I don't know what the mood was like in the time machine that took you to the 50s. What was the lighting like in there?
It was pretty stark and clinical, and it smelled like sleeping pills.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's definitely not the mood here.
Yeah. No, this is much nicer.
Yeah. I mean, we did install, well, the time machine itself. So some of the updates are kind of quirky. And the time machine itself installed a mosquito door. I don't know if you noticed that when we kind of came in, but it's like this weird swinging thing.
Yeah.
And I think that it was responding to the sugar ant problem that we have.
Mm.
It doesn't keep the sugar ants out.
Yeah, no.
It but swings we don't open. Have any mosquitoes.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. So, do you know anything about the character, Baron Munchausen?
Actually, yeah. When I was in college, after finding this movie again, I got kind of obsessed because it felt so revelatory that the movie actually was real. And then I found some books about, like, of Baron Munchausen's stories.
Did you read them?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I've been wanting to, like, since doing this research, but I haven't really read any of them.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty great. So, like, him as a person, he was basically just kind of a drunkard. Some say that he was Russian. Some say that he was German. And he was, like, a soldier that retired from foreign wars kind of thing. So that's why he drank all the time. And most of the time he'd be telling stories of being a soldier, but sometimes he would say things like, one time he was chopping a tree and then his horse startled him and he accidentally threw the hatchet and it landed on the moon.
That is great.
Yeah. And so he had to climb a tree and then throw a lasso so that he could climb onto the moon so he could go get his hatchet back. Yeah. And so it would just like go crazy directions like that. The books mention his pals, like his servants in the movie. One of the characters in the movie is actually kind of like two of them mashed together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the movie really kind of touches on the spirit of the stories a lot.
That's awesome. So I like I said, I haven't read any of them. I kind of briefly read about the character and what it has kind of like the impact that it's had, especially in European culture.
Oh.
Because the character is based on a real person. He was a German nobleman in the 1700s, and he was known in German aristocratic circles for telling tall tales.
Yeah.
And then the man that wrote the book heard some of his stories and adapted them.
Oh.
And exaggerated them further.
Okay.
You know, there's like several different different things that have been named after the character.
Yeah.
Like the medical condition.
Yeah. I actually just read a book, like an unrelated book, and one of the characters had Munchausen by proxy in it.
Oh, what was the name of the book?
Sharp Objects, Gillian Flynn.
Oh, I've seen the HBO show.
Oh, cool. Yeah, she's very good.
Yeah, it was a really good series. And then there's also a philosophical concept that's named after him.
What's that?
It has to do with, this is me like trying to pull out the gist of what I remember reading.
Yeah.
And I haven't really studied a lot of philosophy, so here we go.
Okay.
It has to do with proving the truth of something and that nothing can really truly be proven because you need to keep offering proof. For the proof.
Oh.
So the only like, there's only like a few solutions and none of them are really good because it's either, it just brings you back in circles.
Yeah.
Now that's just me like trying to put into words what I got out of that, but I know there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
And then there was a mathematical equation that was so complex that I didn't spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. Anyway, the movie.
Yeah.
Baron Munchausen. You mentioned before that the other movie you really liked to watch when you were little was Time Bandits.
Yeah.
Did you know that Time Bandits and Baron Munchausen are two of an informal trilogy?
I only learned that kind of recently at a different party because I was talking about how much I like this movie.
How funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like it's an informal trilogy by Terry Gilliam about the imagination.
Yeah.
And Time Bandits is about the imagination of youth. Brazil mm-hmm. is the second one. And that's about middle age. And then The Adventures of Baron Munchausen is late life.
Oh, wow. That's different from what party friend told me.
What did they say?
They said it was like contemplations of the dreamer. And so Baron Munchausen is when the dreamer wins. Time Bandits kind of middle of the road, and Brazil is when the dreamer is crushed.
Oh, well, different interpretations, I guess.
Yeah.
The one that this is the one I came across.
And yeah, no, and that makes sense too.
I'm not really very familiar with any of these movies. I've watched all three of them before,
mm-hmm.
but researching this movie is probably the second time I've ever watched it.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had said before that you had researched a lot of this when you finally discovered the movie again.
Yeah.
So you're familiar that this movie had a lot of production issues.
A little bit. I wasn't very much into film when I was researching it. So like, I don't super know what that means, but I remember that it was so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I can totally see that looking at the set pieces. Like it's beautiful. But yeah, it was really expensive and it didn't make any of its money back. That's about all I know.
Yeah. Okay. Well then I will tell you the story.
Yeah.
It's like, this was a difficult one, I think, because there were there were so many issues and so many personal feelings involved that a lot of what I was coming across, like they're pointing fingers at people and trying to place the blame. And, and I think it's just, there's so many gaps in this and I don't really understand studio politics very well. So I did my best without trying to get too gossipy about things.
Yeah.
So the original budget was $23.5 million.
That's so much money.
But when it was complete, it had gone over budget by nearly doubling that amount.
That's so much money.
And then it went on to bomb in the box office, only making $8.1
million. Man.
But by contrast, it was praised by critics and was nominated for several awards.
Hmm.
So this is not a film like a lot of the ones we've covered with this podcast. It's not one that was appreciated in retrospect. It was appreciated contemporaneously with the other movies coming out.
Yeah.
It did not get the box office turnout that they were they were wanting. So you may be asking, what's the story behind this disparity?
Yeah, what's the story behind this disparity?
Thank you so much for asking. So the story is like a true comedy of errors and bad luck. And when the going got really tough, it took a lot of flexibility and imagination to finish this movie.
Mm.
Which, strangely enough, I would say that...
Yeah, fits thematically.
Exactly. So the first rumble of the avalanche of bad luck began when filming had to be delayed for a week because the elaborate set that they'd made for the movie wasn't complete and then was postponed further by another week when a crane fell into the set and it had to be remade.
And just to make sure, like a bird crane or a machine crane?
I believe it was a machine crane.
Okay.
And now that you mention it, I don't think they were very clear on that.
Yeah, it could have been anything.
Yeah. I mean, those cranes are known to be really destructive.
Absolutely.
You know, laying eggs in the wrong places and
yeah.
Yeah, and just their awful beaks.
Oh, yeah. Very sharp.
So, whichever crane it was, they had to wait for the set to be remade. And by the time they started filming, it was already $2 million over budget.
Whoa.
So most of the film was shot in Cinecittà Studios in Rome.
Oh.
Yeah. So half of the crew were English speakers and half of the crew were Italian speakers.
Whoa.
So as you can imagine, there were a lot of communication issues,
yeah,
which kind of slowed down the whole process. And it just meant that it was more money because it was more time.
Yeah.
And on top of that, due to the oppressive hot climate in Rome, they could only shoot at night.
Oh, wow.
So it resulted in production already being a week behind schedule after the first week of shooting once they started.
Wow.
With only 17 minutes of film.
Oh, my God.
So things didn't fare any better on location in Algeria, Spain, the mm-hmm. second location they went to. So when they arrived, an outbreak of horse fever was inflicting the horses of Spain. So there were four horses they'd been training for months in Italy to perform in this movie, and they were forbidden from bringing them over because of horse fever. Yeah. And the problems in Spain don't stop there, because the costumes that they had made and were shipped over from Rome were being detained at the airport because the Spanish custom workers were on strike.
Oh my God.
But Terry Gilliam was like, okay, we're gonna work around it, we'll film something else, like we'll do it anyway.
Yeah.
And but then there were these horrible gusting winds that kept blowing over set pieces and destroying things.
Wow.
So after the first day in Spain, they only shot 24 seconds. And then the second day, 35 seconds.
Oh my God. Do you know which seconds?
I wish I did. I actually, so I told you how I found that documentary and I was trying to watch it before you came and I was getting a lot more information and a better idea. I think that some of those seconds were a battle scene.
Okay.
Like towards the end.
Yeah.
But I cannot be certain of
it. Oh, yeah. I could believe that.
Yeah.
I think I know which one you're talking about. That was such a confusing scene for me because I remember the battle ending in a lot of different ways. Like I told you that there were parts of it because I would fall asleep while I was watching the movie. And so there are parts of it that I just dreamed that didn't actually happen, but they're like as real in my memory as when I watch the movie now and watch it. So like I've seen that battle end a lot of different ways.
Wow, that's so fascinating.
It's really
weird. Do you remember the way it actually ends in the movie?
So I remember, is spoilers okay? I
mean, at this point when we're in the time machine,
yeah,
spoilers are okay.
So I remember strong man swinging the boats in a circle and I think he throws them and then they like, and then somehow everyone's defeated. Like the tent falls down and then they like go back into the city, but then they're also inside the city. And then also he disappears from on top of a hill.
Okay. I mean, honestly, like, I'm not even sure how it ends. I've forgotten.
Yeah.
Because it is, like, it, yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to know, like, once we rejoin ourselves out there.
Yeah. What do we think about it?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right. So back to the story. With all these disasters and setbacks, the budget fallout was rapidly increasing. Mm-hmm. And it didn't help that Columbia TriStar Pictures was undergoing a pretty massive regime change. So this is where I mentioned before, it starts to get complex and
finger pointy.
Yes. And I'm not sure if what I'm saying is going to be entirely correct. So the original deal, it seems, had been made with the then Columbia head, David Putnam. It had been, like, on paper, the budget was $23.5 million, but the oral agreement was that it would be more like $35
million. Whoa.
And so when he was fired and they brought in a new head of, yeah, of Columbia TriStar, her name was Dawn Steele, and she was the first woman to be head of a major film studio, just a side note.
Yeah.
And she was not interested in any oral agreement that David Putnam had made.
Yeah.
So Terry Gilliam at that point felt like it was just always a struggle to try to convince her of anything having to do with the movie because of David Putnam's association with it. And also by this time, the film was receiving a lot of publicity, because it was such a huge production in Italy.
Yeah.
And most of the publicity was not very good.
Oh no.
Yeah. It exaggerated the production issues that were happening on set and like talked about being way over budget, and it painted Terry Gilliam as completely inept as a director.
Oh, I feel like he's still fighting that a little.
Yeah. Well, so here is where it gets a little gossipy and I wasn't really sure, apparently, it was later revealed that these stories, like the sources of these stories, mm-hmm, were coming from this lawyer for film finances, which was the completion bond company for the movie. And this lawyer was the son of a producer named Martin Ransohoff, who was friends and business partners with a man named Ray Stark. And Ray Stark had an ongoing feud with David Putnam.
Oh, whoa.
So,
drama.
If that's all true, it seems like it's really petty to,
yeah,
like, to put that out there, but who knows? So, yeah. But eventually film finances took over because of how it was going and all of like the increasing spending for this movie and,
yeah,
and the longer timeline and everything. So they took over, they shut everything down, they fired the whole crew, and they were going to, wow, sue Terry Gilliam for fraud and attempted to replace him as a director.
Wow.
And this is kind of, I don't know if you've ever heard about Terry Gilliam infamously punching out the window of someone's car.
No.
That happened during
this whole thing. He's so strong.
Yeah, and I think it was apparently like really uncharacteristic of him, but yeah, the whole thing was so stressful and so upsetting.
Yeah.
And, so like they had to go through many negotiations to try to get this going because of like the way that it works with studios, like they wouldn't have accepted this film if it wasn't completed by Terry Gilliam.
Mm-hmm.
So he was kind of held hostage anyway. And so after many negotiations, they scaled back the production costs so that the film could be completed.
Mm-hmm.
So Baron Munchausen was way over budget, incomplete, and it wasn't getting any more money. And sometimes I'm sure you've experienced this before. Like sometimes like when you're backed into a corner and, mm-hmm, you don't know what to do, like the most remarkable things happen and solutions pop up.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened at this point. Oh. And this is actually my favorite part of the whole story.
Yeah. I like that.
The best example of this phenomenon in this movie was in the Moon Kings sequence, which is one of my favorites of the whole movie.
Yeah.
Did you know that Sean Connery was originally slated to be the Moon King?
No. Oh. Yeah.
So, when the role of the Moon King was largely cut after the negotiations with film finances, Sean Connery felt like the changes left the character unkingly, so he dropped out.
Yeah, but I'm not mad about it, honestly.
No.
Yeah.
So apparently Gene Wilder and Walter Matthau were both considered for the role of the Moon King.
Oh.
And I don't know what happened to them, but I think Terry Gilliam, who was probably very desperate at this point, called in a favor because Robin Williams flew in last minute to play the part, shot everything almost immediately after getting off the plane.
Wow.
Ad-libbed nearly all of his lines and then did it all uncredited and unpaid.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never watched the credits. Oh my God.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
That is so nuts. What was he doing with his career around that time? This movie was made or like released in like 88. So
yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, me neither.
I'm not sure. This would have been way after Mork and Mindy, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
Before like Aladdin and like Patch Adams and stuff like that.
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so something else about that scene.
Yeah.
So like originally there was supposed to be like tons of people and like all a whole bunch of different inhabitants of the moon city.
Yeah.
But after budget cuts, they were limited to two, the Moon King and the Moon Queen.
Yeah.
And there was a whole elaborate moon city set that was supposed to be built, but there was no money left. So what they did was they took all of the sketches that they'd drawn for the set, glued them onto boards, cut them out, and then moved them all independently from each other. And that's like what you're seeing in that scene.
That works so well, too.
I know. Isn't it cool?
Yeah, that makes the whole place feel like a clockwork playground.
To me, it feels like operatic scenery.
Yeah.
Like, kind of like they have at the very beginning of the movie when they're on stage.
Absolutely.
I mean, I would not have known that was not the intention.
Absolutely. Yeah. That seemed so perfectly in line with like what the character was. And like they bring back, like they call lots of parts of the movie where it's like the real part, like kind of harken back to the onstage part in such ways. Yeah. It felt so on purpose. I had no idea.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
So, one other example of limits working out in a way, anyway, is in the Vulcan scene.
Yeah.
So originally there was supposed to be a whole herd of cattle.
Oh.
And
like in the volcano?
Yeah. But because of the budget, they were only allowed to have one.
Yeah.
And I think that's funny. I think that's funnier. He's like, here's this one cow.
Yeah.
So two side notes about this scene. So Uma Thurman plays Venus.
Mm-hmm.
And this was her very first acting job.
Really?
Yeah. And she got hired without a callback. And apparently that's really unusual.
Yeah.
And then the ballroom set in the Vulcan scene is the library from the film Name of the Rose.
Oh.
They had to, because like, you know, they couldn't film where they wanted to film. And so they didn't have a budget anymore. So they reused this, the scenery.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I like how much that scene transforms, like as they start floating, like it really does feel like a different place.
Yeah, it was cool. Like in that documentary I was just watching, it was talking about how the location they originally wanted to do that was this actual structure in Spain where it has all of these fountains and these pools of water, and that's where they wanted to film, but then they didn't get permission to do it.
Oh no.
And so when they had they had to build a set, but they didn't have the money for it. So they used that and just kind of covered it up and made all the fountains come out.
Yeah.
And that's why they were trying to make it look like the location that they wanted.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. So when the film was released in the United States in 1989, because it was released in 1988 in Europe, Columbia TriStar was in the process of being sold to Sony. And about this time, Don Steele was asked to leave Columbia because it continued the string of losses that began under David Putnam.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was Don reading, had her work cut out for her.
Huh?
Don had her work cut out for her.
Yeah. We might want to cut this out, but I read all this stuff about the practice in big companies about hiring women or people or minorities to take over struggling businesses so they can fire them.
Yeah.
Like if they continue to struggle and then replace them with a white male.
I've heard about that.
And I feel like that's kind of like,
yeah. Like we get the bonus points for hiring a lady, but then also we don't get in trouble for like firing her.
Right. So when Sony took over, they sort of swept all the films in production under the rug because they weren't interested in the success of any of the films produced under the old regime. So none of these, like the Baron Munchausen wasn't the only one to really, you know, suffer from that, from that merger or the transition. But it was the most visible and the most subject of scrutiny. So it's the one that got all of the attention. And I think the reason it grossed so little is really very, very simple. The studio did absolutely no advertising for it.
Oh my God.
And then only made 117 prints to distribute in only the major cities.
Oh, wow.
And, just for comparison, Terry Gilliam said that art films at the time would get 400 prints.
Dang. That seems like such sabotage.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. So you were lucky if you got to see this movie in theaters. I would love to see this movie on a big screen.
Oh man, it would have been great.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it would have been, it's so unusual. But on the bright side, where they did open, they opened extremely well and the critics raved about it.
Yeah.
It revitalized John Neville's film career, who played the Baron.
Oh.
He'd always been more interested in theater.
Yeah.
But he was a fan of Monty Python, so he took the role.
Yeah.
And after that, he went on to make several appearances in movies and TV.
That's cool.
And I don't know. Were you a fan of The X-Files?
Yes.
So he played the well-manicured man.
Whoa.
Not the cancer man, but...
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I was like, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So that is the story that I've been able to like patch together from all the different sources that I was looking at. And there's so much that I didn't even talk about. There was so many things that went wrong and so many different stressors happening. But like, does that change the way you think about this movie, knowing about all that went on?
It makes me feel like almost proud, like proud for Terry Gilliam. Like I'm happy that it got to be made despite all that, because I feel like this movie is so beautiful that it would have been a shame if it had just been abandoned and like left on the floor, you know.
I agree. It was definitely a grand idea.
Yeah.
And like, how many times does a grand idea actually get to see
exactly
completion?
Yeah, like sometimes I want to see like the dreamers and the story makers like make that impractical idea. Like, I want to see those things succeed. And so this is a very, like, hopeful movie.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think the time machine is slowing down, which means they must be finishing watching the movie out there. I mean, we are finishing watching the movie out there.
Yeah, I can hear the awe radiating from the audience, so I think you're right.
So just to let you know, when you do step off of the time machine, you will rejoin yourself pretty rapidly. So you might have a moment... because you're going to be catching up with everything that went on out there.
Like Naruto.
Yeah. Like Naruto.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that.
One of his techniques is he can split himself into multiple bodies. And so if he like wants to learn something really fast, he just makes like 5 versions of himself and like each version tries. And then once he like rejoins, he gets all of the knowledge, but also all of the like exhaustion.
Oh, wow. So then he's like out for a while.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay.
But you will be confused as you're like your two consciences become one again.
Okay.
And you have to like try to make sense of the two different experiences.
Okay.
So if you need anything, just let me know.
Thanks. Okay. I appreciate you.
All right. I think let's go.
All right.
All passengers must return to their respective times. Goodbye.
All right. So here we are.
Yeah.
You've just rejoined yourself.
I know. I am a little bit woozy.
Do you feel oriented?
I feel both old and young at the same time.
You know, that's very apt.
Thanks.
So, like, now that you've rejoined yourself, how do you feel about watching with this group of people?
I'm still a little nervous because this is such a big part of my existence, and I feel like I am a big part of who I am is because of this movie, so I feel really exposed. But also, people laughed, people applauded, so I feel pretty good.
Well, how does everybody feel after watching this movie? Yeah, I have a general sense that people enjoyed it.
Cool. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Terry Gilliam.
So I'd like to open it up. Like, let's get a show of hands right now. Is there anybody here that's seen this movie before? All right.
Tell us about it.
Oh, well, I had forgotten I'd watched this movie. And my father is a big Terrence Gilliam fan. Which is weird if you've ever met him. He's like this big, like, oil baron kind of guy. So it was a lot of fun to rewatch it. And I remember watching, like, all the other works that that director did, like Monty Python and things like that. And just very nostalgic because of my father. He's still alive, though, so that's always fun, too.
Do you have memories of this movie?
It's one of those movies that I, like, for... Not that I had forgotten that I had watched it, but I thought I had dreamt it.
Yeah.
It was like a total fever dream from when I was a child. And then I revisited accidentally on TV, like when I was in high school. And I was like, no way did this actually get made.
Yeah.
Because those puppets feel like something that came like straight out of like a child's brain.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had the same thing. I thought I made this up for years.
Okay. So I actually watched this movie for the first time when I was relatively older. I was like, I think I was 19. And I think this is where I fell in love with Terry Gilliam as a director. You're completely right. It was very much a sense of childhood imagination and wonder that was very quickly and suddenly and over the course of an hour and a half, given a lot of validity. And it's just an absolute adventure. How was it put? And these aren't my words. I want to make that clear. But it's an odyssey, and I loved it, and I still love it. Watching it again, it is 100% everything I thought it was, and continues to be. That's my opinion on it.
All right, Haley, I'm glad that you have the microphone because I want this question to start with you. Oh. So, watching this movie, there is nudity in it. And you said you were 6 years old the first time you ever watched it.
Yeah.
Did that strike you in any particular way? Or, like, do you have any memories of the first time you ever saw nudity in film or TV?
So it definitely didn't strike me in this movie. It actually took me a long time to even recognize that, like, the women in the harem were nude. Like, the first one that struck me was, like, Uma Thurman holding her boob. But I feel like for a long time, I just didn't even associate bodies with this because this movie didn't seem very physical. Like, I didn't understand the scenes on the moon. Like, I took the, like, tickling her feet very literally. I feel like it took a long time before I even noticed, like, nudity in a film, and this wasn't part of it.
When was the first time?
So I think it was this movie with maybe Janine Garofalo. It was, like, Cats and Dogs, or, like, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, maybe. And there was, like, a phone sex scene. And I don't even remember if there was actually nudity, but that was the first time I remember feeling, like, oh, awkwardness in bodies. Oh, goodness.
How about anybody else?
So the question is, the first time, like, I registered nudity in a film, it was definitely The Last Unicorn with the harpy. And she has, like, those giant pendulous breasts as she's, like, descending upon, like, Mama Fortuna. Wow. And it was the first time I was like, boobs.
At one point when I was in high school, I was really into Pink Floyd. And I looked up the movie version of The Wall by Pink Floyd. And there is a dancing scene where there is a topless woman. And I was not prepared for that. It's just, you know, it happens sometimes. You accidentally find nudity in films you're looking up. Yeah?
When I was younger, my dad would take us to movies that were definitely inappropriate for the age that we were at. And he took me to see Starship Troopers. And I remember a sex scene that they had in the movie and being like, oh, that's what they're doing. And I had to have been like 6 years old or something. And I was just like, oh, this is awkward. And they're boning right now. Okay. And that's the first thing I remember.
That's hilarious. I was literally just about to say Starship Troopers. The shower scene in Starship Troopers where you're just like, oh, those are boobs. But also a weird, like, we had HBO when I was a child, and Eyes Wide Shut played a lot. And I was like, what is this? Oh! I didn't understand half that movie. I probably still don't. But I always remembered boobs, and that's about it.
I was one of the many who fell at Titanic. You know? It wasn't because it was the first movie that I ever like really registered boobs. It was just the first movie I was allowed to watch with boobs in it. You know, it was just like there was no other one. My parents wouldn't let me watch anything with any sort of sexual reference in it at all. But Titanic was apparently okay.
I remember watching Trading Places when I was like 8, and my parents made me close my eyes in the scene where the woman gets out of bed and her boobs are out. But I like peeked through my eyes, but that was like a punchline. That wasn't like, you know, really thinking about people's bodies. But the first time I remember thinking about like, oh, realizing like sexuality in movies, and this is maybe TMI, don't read into this too much, guys. But I think it was GoldenEye, the James Bond movie, where there's a woman who, she's a villain, and she seduces men and then breaks their necks with her thighs. And that was the first time I was like, huh, okay, so this is more than just like a joke, you know? This is like... and I was about 9 at the time, so we'll just stop there.
Also super similar, I watched Airplane when I was like 6, and there's like that one gag where it's just like a shot of a naked lady's breast and she's like bouncing on a plane. I was like, oh. And they were gone immediately. But yeah, that was the first time I was like aware of like something being odd.
So the first time I realized that nudity was a thing, it wasn't sexual. It was more of just general discomfort. I was watching Monty Python's Search for the Holy Grail, actually. And the cartoons where there's like the angels have their tits exposed and they're blowing trumpets through their ass. There was something about that I realized was very, very wrong for my sheltered existence. But for some reason, that was the one movie that got through at a very, very young age in my family.
Okay, so it may have been a movie before this, but the first one that I remember seeing with boobs in it was 1984. And it stands out to me most prominently because at one point in the movie, my mom goes, the nudity is okay because it is not like, I don't remember exactly what she said, but long story short, it's not specifically overtly sexual at this particular point. So it's okay. We're going to skip past those points in it. And I could just remember looking back at the screen and going, oh shit, tits.
So this one's a little bit of a weird one. The first time I actually realized that nudity was a different thing than just like clothes was actually watching The Little Mermaid. Like when she washes up, I was like, oh, why can't she suddenly show her midriff now? Like when she was a fish, that was fine. I just...
Okay, so you just brought up The Little Mermaid, which means that animated nudity counts, yes? All right.
Yes.
Because I just remembered that, like, when I was a small child, there's an episode of Dexter's Laboratory where he does a cannonball into a pool too hard, and then you see his exposed butt. So the first film nudity that I saw was Dexter's ass.
Anybody else? Okay, next question. So this movie is about tall tales and exaggerating within a story to make it better. Do any of y'all have friends, or did you yourself enjoy telling tall tales when you were younger?
Oh, yeah, I made shit up all the time when I was a kid. Like, nonstop. It was like, oh, well, this is a cool story that this person's telling. I want to feel included, so I'm going to tell this other story that may kind of happen, but not really. I need to be closer. So, yeah, I feel like kids do that a lot to feel included and just, you know, it's always fun telling stories and stuff, and I feel like a lot of people hanging around here are all storytellers, so I keep telling those lies.
I don't necessarily have one that I told, but when I was younger, my grandpa, my great-grandpa made up a whole story about this man in the woods that was very scary, and if you went out at nighttime, he'd totally kill you. And he was the cougar man, and and there was also like cougars out, you know, like they tell you about the like cougar lions and stuff. And so we went to the bunkhouse, which is where they would go hunting all the time. And they would tell us this scary story about the cougar man that was going to eat you or kill you when you went outside, if you weren't supposed to after dark. And my great grandpa would sneak outside and wait until we were in the middle of the story. My grandpa was telling me he knew what was going on, and he'd bang on the window. And we would all be like, "Oh!" and be super scared. We never wanted to go outside at night ever at the cabin ever. And I feel like that's kind of a tall tale. It was totally made up, but you know.
Well, speaking of grandparents, you made me remember when I was little, my grandfather would tell me stories about things that, you know, just to mess with me, because when I was little, I believed anything that an adult told me. And
healthy.
And he totally took advantage of that and to his own amusement. And I do not begrudge that at all, because I'm sure it was hilarious. But he told me that the birds that flew really, really high, because they lived in the country in outside of Jacksonville, Texas. And the birds that flew really, really high in circles around were American bald eagles. And I believed him. And I would go to school the next day or after the weekend was over we had show and tell on Mondays, and I'd tell my whole class. I went to my grandparents' house and saw American bald eagles. Yeah, it was only later that I realized that they were buzzards.
Dang. Well, I guess everyone can relate to this, but speaking of Munchausen, I think the biggest tall tales that I would tell when I was a kid was pretending that I was sick so I could get off school. You know, like, hey, there, tippy bartender, tippy waitress. But for real, though. Because everyone did that. Like, I distinctly remember being a child and, like, being in a group of friends and all of us swapping trade secrets on how to fake sick. So, because I'm like, okay, this test is really hard. And it's in 3 days from now. And instead of studying for it, we're all going to fake sick, you know? And it was like, you know, like the whole, like, yeah, like your mom, like, puts a thermometer in your mouth and you're like, I'm thirsty, get me water. Then you, like, when she's gone, you're like rubbing the thermometer between like the sheets in your fingers to make it seem like you're like having a fever, or like rubbing your face so you can like feel hotter than you are. Anyway, that's probably the biggest of lies that I would tell. And I wanted to make a Munchausen syndrome joke. Bye.
That reminds me of something I did once in sixth grade. We had like a substitute teacher in science class. And I was like, hey, I'm not going to do this work, substitute teacher. Fuck you. And then the normal teacher came back and she's like, all right, where's your assignments? And I didn't have them. I'd like totally lost them. And so I was like, oh, no, sorry, I'm sick. And then I like went home and my grandparents were super trusting. And so I did this for a whole month. Yeah. And then somehow it worked out. Like my history teacher was pissed because like history was after science. So I missed like history for a full month too. But then I just like made cookies instead of researched Rome. And it worked out because. Yeah, no, Louisiana schools are bunk.
Long story short, cookies solve everything.
Absolutely, yeah. Long story short, cookies solve everything.
I used to make up stories when I was a little girl. I grew up on 10 acres on a lake, on a house that was in the middle of a forest, and I would invite my friends over. And then it was a sleepover. And so then as they're all getting like tired and it's getting darker and darker, I tell them, don't you know that this house was built on a cat cemetery, a Native American cat cemetery? And it was sacred ground and we're encroaching on their property. And so the cats will come to kill us if we fall asleep. And I would have them all line up along the window that faced the lake because we had sliding glass doors. So I would line them up in front of the glass doors. And then I would have my older sister shine little reflective lights that we had in the backyard. And I'd be like, those are their eyes. Those are their eyes and they're going to kill you. yeah, and then eventually they'd all fall asleep and no one would die. So
I told really only one, and I've always been a really bad liar, and but when I was in third grade, I distinctly remember being really bored. Baseball practice, I think it was. It was like just sitting in the dugout, like doing nothing. And I started telling the kid who sat next to me like this big old story about how me and my twin were in like a war of children back in our old home in Seattle, because we were living in Tampa at this point. We had just moved from Seattle, and we're like back in Seattle. In the middle of the rainforest, we were in a war of children where like hundreds of children forming multiple factions were like scattered throughout these woods and painted different colors, and everyone had cool weapons like slingshots and paintball guns and sticks and stuff. One kid had a sword, and it's like we just made. I'm like Crow and I together made this whole thing up and just like told this kid this like probably 10 different stories just about this war, and kept it going for like a couple weeks at baseball practice, like over and over again. He'd be like, tell me more about the war. Like, I want to hear what happened. Like, and so we kept telling him about it. And then finally, I just was feeling so horrible about how big of a lie this was and how I couldn't keep this going for the rest of my life. And I told my mom, and I was like, Mom, what do I do? Like, I've been telling this kid that I was in this war and it's not a real war. And she's like, well, honey, you have to tell the truth. So the next time I went to baseball practice, I was like, I don't even remember this kid's name, but I'm like, hey, man, I gotta tell you, none of what I told you was true. And he was really cool about it. He's like, I know.
This is the last thing that I can think of as like a tall tale, but my dad looks a lot like Jack Black. And so when I was younger, kind of like middle school era, I would tell everybody that Jack Black was my uncle. Because I look a lot like him too, and like my dad looks just like him, and I was like, oh yeah, Jack Black's my uncle, y'all. Like, don't even worry about it, it's cool.
That reminded me of my thing. So thank you. My last name is Windsor. like the royal family, but unrelated. So when I was like 6 or 7, my family took a trip to England and we got to visit the castle and everything. And my dad had been prepping me and telling me that the queen was my great aunt. So we got in and he was like, there's a guard. Go ask him to see your great aunt. And I did. And the guard, I remember the guard looking at me and being like, oh yeah? How do you spell Windsor? And he didn't know it was actually my last name, so I spelled it correctly. And I think he just ignored me after that.
All right, so I still love to make up stories. Like, if I can get enough people in a room that will just believe, I think they'll believe whatever I say, I'll just, like, try to make something up and see if they'll believe it. So a recent thing is I used to live on Blueberry Trail, which is right down the street, and I randomly one day made up the story that Blueberry Trail is named Blueberry Trail because there used to be a blueberry farm over in that neighborhood. And Mueller, before it was an airport, was a nuclear facility. And all the blueberry farms got contaminated, and so all the people who are farming blueberries, it turned their skin blue. And everyone I told this to in that moment just believed me. And I just kept this going for probably like a month. And I was like, you know, it's kind of like a double-edged sword because I want to get the gratification of like seeing them realize that's not true. And so one day I did tell them, but you know, I think they realized it at some point. So yeah.
So I don't know how this happened, but one evening I alluded to a story to a friend that I was kicked out of the city of Cincinnati and that I was never allowed back. And I didn't tell him the story because I couldn't think of one, but apparently it was convincing enough that every time I talk with him, which is maybe every 6 months or so now, he asks me if I can tell him that, and I always tell him that I'm not ready to share this this story. And I really hope I can keep this up for the rest of my life.
Nathan, you should tell the tall tale of the trailer park.
Oh, that is a good one. Can I tell another one? Uh-huh. So when I was in college, I lived in a trailer park that was wonderful in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere. And we had this one resident who lit her trailer on fire 3 times. And there was some way that she did it every time that was different. But a friend of mine and I, we decided to embellish the story. And we told this elaborate thing where she was in a leopard suit and she had rum and she had candles and she threw the bottle over and said, I'll cap that later. And then her trailer went up in flames. And that was actually kind of the truth. But we told this story and we're like, let's make it the real story. And so it happened. It spread through the trailer park. It was mostly true. I didn't go back for several years. I went back last time, maybe 7 years after I moved out. And somebody said, oh, do you know the story about this trailer over here? And they pointed to this trailer that this woman lived in. And I was like, no, tell me the story. And they told this fantastical story about how this trailer got lit on fire that had absolutely zero truth to it at all. The only thing was that the trailer got lit on fire, and there was this whole fantasy that was just incredible what these people had done with this story without knowing about it. But the last line that he told me in this story was, I'll cap that later.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, for coming and sharing your stories. Really appreciate it. Haley.
Yeah.
Now that we've watched this movie, and have you ever watched it with a group this size before?
Definitely not.
So what was your experience watching it with everyone and knowing that everyone enjoyed it?
I did really like being part of sort of a room full of laughter and the applause at the end of the movie. caveat, I'm not normally a big applause at the end of the movie person, but I enjoyed it this time.
Oh, you're right. That's really good.
Yeah. One urge that I kept having to fight is I kept wanting to explain things to people or be like, did you notice that? Did you notice that? Did you see that? Did you see that poster? It's about cannibalism.
That's true. At the very beginning.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for choosing this movie and sharing it with everybody. Everybody. Sorry.
You're
everyone,
welcome.
Everybody. Either mm-hmm. or. Yes.
Yeah, everybody in every head.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I don't know if I trust y'all very much now that I've heard all these stories about y'all telling lies.
And everybody's like, you know, fibbing.
That's true. Yeah, it's possible that none of these stories are true, that everyone just came up with stories to seem like liars.
Right. Yeah, you know, everybody's super honest.
Yeah.
They just came up with stories to make them seem dishonest.
Yeah, yeah, because you know what? Deep down, everything is true.
Well, if you don't have anything further, one last final thing is if anybody listening has any stories that they... about watching this movie when they were little or stories about any of the party questions that we've asked, email us at memorystatic@gmail.com.
Yes, please do.
And other than that, this is Memory Static. Return your videos here.
Be kind, rewind.
I thought that I would find something for us to do that was outside the normal thing for us to do. I thought of something that would be for just us two. How would you feel about a picnic on the moon? On our picnic on the moon, we'll say goodbye to planet living. We'll eat the tastiest, fattiest foods, 'cause the gravity's more forgiving. We'll admire the earth from miles away and pick the pale moon flowers and talk of never going back, at least for a few more hours. Well, do not think that we have finished yet, my dear. We're merely returning to our own atmosphere. So take the chance to wave goodbye to the moon before we race through the clouds in our hot air balloons. As we travel through the blue, the things are so small down below. The balloons will be so very fast as the wind should blow. We'll see such sights at extreme heights. It's close, but who will win? Either way, it's you, it's me. We can always go again. Well, that was good, but I don't think it was quite right. What if we were suddenly in black and white? So take my hand and trust me, and away we'll go to star in an old-timey silent picture show. Well, on the silver screen, we'll both be great lip readers. A piano will play whatever we do and won't miss a single meter. I'll bat my eyes, you'll heave a sigh and mouth that, and then you'll see upon the screen I say.
Memory Static is hosted by Bailey Moore and produced and edited by me, Eric Dumig. Special thanks to Haley Clement for being the guest on this month's episode, and special thanks to Geronimo, Delilah, and Yakko for hosting the party. Music for this episode is by Bailey and Cullen Moore. If you like the show, subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, and if you happen to be on Apple Music, please consider giving us a rate and review, as this will help us get to more ears. Also, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/memorystatic. This is a listener-supported show, and every little bit makes a difference. Thanks for listening.